This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and today I'm thrilled to say that our guest is an internationally recognized expert in the area of election law, but also one of my former professors. We're speaking to UCLA professor Rick Hassan, and he is one of the most prolific scholars in the areas of election law, legislation, and much more. Professor Hassan has served as a CNN and NBC and MSNBC election law analyst. He directs UCLA's Safeguarding Democracy Project. He also is the founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication, The Election Law Journal. He began the very famous and well-read election law blog. He has been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal. He's also been named one of the top 100 lawyers in California by the Los Angeles and San Francisco Daily Journals. His op-eds and commentaries have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Politico, and Slate. Today, our conversation focuses on two of Professor Hassan's most recent books. The first is A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. And the other is Cheap Speech: How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with one of my former professors and mentors and truly one of the best known legal scholars in the world, Professor Rick Hassan. So again, I'm so glad that you could be here. And I want to start by talking about your most recent book, A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. A lot of people probably think the right to vote is in the Constitution. Can you go ahead and give us the big surprise that it's not really there?
Well, first, let me say thank you, Jessica, for having me on your show. And since you're a former student of mine, let me just say how much I enjoy seeing the success of my former students, including you, and watching you be a thriving commentator throughout the real and virtual world. So it is great to see you sharing your wisdom with others. So thank you for that.
We're all only as good as our teachers, so thank you.
That is not true, but sure. So to come back to your question, the Constitution phrases protections for the right to vote in the negative. So if you're going to have an election, don't discriminate on the basis of race. If you're going to have an election, don't discriminate on the basis of gender, etc. To go back to the original Constitution, you may remember that there was no right to vote for president. That was done by state legislatures. There was no right to vote for the Senate. That was done by state legislatures. And who was allowed to vote for the U.S. House of Representatives? Only those who were eligible to vote under state law. So it deferred the question to state law. In 1874, a woman named Virginia Minor went to the Supreme Court and she said, you know, we just passed the 14th Amendment after the Civil War. It guarantees me the privileges or immunities of citizenship. I'm a citizen. Missouri's not letting me vote because I'm a woman. And the Supreme Court said, you are a citizen, but the right to vote is not a privilege or immunity of citizenship. It's up to the state of Missouri. And it took another 40 plus years before the 19th Amendment was added to the Constitution, barring discrimination on the basis of gender in voting. So we do not have a right to vote in the Constitution. In 2000, in the Bush versus Gore case, the Supreme Court reminded us that we only can vote for president because of the grace of state legislatures that give us that power. So the right to vote in the United States is far more precarious than most people recognize.
So I think that what flows from that, you just use the word precarious, is that we can limit the right to vote. And you follow this more than any person, frankly, I think, in the world, which is different ways that we limit people's right to vote. And I'm wondering if you could bring this home for people listening in terms of What exactly does that mean when we say people are disenfranchised? I think we hear it, we know it's bad, but talk us through an experience that somebody has when they go to vote or they want to try and register to vote. I mean, what specifically do we mean when we say you were disenfranchised?
So historically, it has meant different things. I mentioned the case of Virginia Minor. She literally was not allowed to vote. I also talk about the case of Jackson Giles, who was a Black man in Alabama who went to the Supreme Court in 1903 and said, what about the 15th Amendment? They're not letting me register to vote. And the Supreme Court said, sorry, nothing we can do about that. That's outright disenfranchisement. We have less of that now in the United States, although we still have some of that. If you live in Puerto Rico, you're a citizen of the United States. You don't get to vote for president or for Congress. If you live in American Samoa, you're in an even worse position. Because someone from Puerto Rico, if they move to Utah, they can vote for president so long as they're a Utah resident. But someone from American Samoa is considered an American national, not a citizen. And they're not allowed to vote, even if they move to Utah. So, you know, that's just kind of the most egregious form of disenfranchisement. But we also see barriers put in front of voters. And some of those, if they're serious enough, I think fairly qualify as disenfranchisement. So, for example, the state of Kansas imposed a law that said, if you want to register to vote, you have to provide documentary proof of citizenship in order to be eligible to vote. Documentary proof of citizenship, like your birth certificate or your naturalization papers. I don't know about you, but when I go to Costco, I don't carry my birth certificate with me. And so if I decided that was where I was going to register to vote, I'd be out of luck. And this Kansas law actually caused 30,000 people to not be registered to vote until a federal court came in, thanks to a lawsuit brought by the ACLU, to put this law on hold. And the law was eventually found to be in violation of federal law. The state law was found to be in violation of federal law, and that was a form of disenfranchisement. I also talk in the book about a law in North Dakota that required people to provide a residential street address before they could actually vote, because North Dakota doesn't have voter registration. And this is a law that imposes a really minor burden on most people, except for two classes of people. People who are unhoused, they don't have a residential street address. And people who are poor and live on Indian reservations, because they don't have paved streets, they don't have street addresses, they use P.O. boxes, they don't even have regular mail service. This is a law that makes it practically impossible for these people to vote. And so I would say that that is effective disenfranchisement. Do you think the term is thrown around very loosely and not every law is that puts a burden in front of voters is disenfranchising? You know, saying that people have to vote on election day and not have early voting. Well, I don't think that's good policy. I don't think that is disenfranchising voters. It's just making it more difficult for voters. You can imagine such a law, if that were the only way to vote and they didn't let people who were in the military vote, that maybe that would we call that disenfranchising. But in terms of inconvenience, that's probably not enough. Where that line is, I think we could have a debate.
So what's on the other side of these burdens? So as you pointed out, we use the word disenfranchisement and we're a bit sloppy about it. There's true disenfranchisement and then there are burdens or barriers. And I think the more common now, as I can see it, is the burdens or barriers, the, you know, give us your street address, you need a specific type of voter ID, you can't vote before election day, or there will only be a certain number of places to vote in your area, and we're going to make it hard to get there. But that's not true disenfranchisement. But I think what people might be wondering is, well, why? I mean, what's on the other side of these restrictions? People do say they serve a purpose. I mean, we always hear, well, they protect the integrity of the process. They guard against fraud. You've studied this in more detail than anybody I know. Is there to those arguments?
Well, certainly we need to have some rules. We can't just say everybody can show up. They can vote as many times as they want. They don't have to have any proof that they are eligible to vote, right? So that would be a disaster. The question is, how are we going to do that? So in California, for the most part, we verify identity through signature matching, which is far from an exact science. We don't tend to have a lot of fraud associated with absentee ballots in California. And so putting in a more rigorous set of rules like a photo ID is probably not necessary in order to protect the integrity of the ballot to assure that only those people who are eligible to vote are allowed to vote. There are trade-offs that come with these things. So, for example, in some states, you cannot collect absentee ballots from other people. And in California, you can collect an unlimited number of absentee ballots from people. So what's the better rule? Well, I actually think that neither rule is very good. I like the rule in Colorado, which says that you can collect, I think, 10 ballots from people. You know, there are some people who are homebound. They might have trouble getting to a post office. Certainly think for people who live on reservations without regular mail service, they would have an issue. But for most of us, not a big deal for us to handle our own ballot. Or, you know, we limit it to family members. So, you know, I could take my wife's ballot to the Dropbox, but not, you know, everyone on my block. We do know that back in 2018, there was some fraud going on with election workers collecting absentee ballots in North Carolina, maybe destroying some ballots, potentially changing some of the results of those ballots. Those things are an indication that there is some issue of fraud. And then we have to balance it with other things. So during the pandemic, we had to balance that against the lack of safety of people congregating closely together before there was a vaccine. Now it's more balanced against convenience. And so, as I said, I think that there are line drawing issues. I think there is the potential for fraud if you allow unlimited third-party collection of ballots. But I think a little bit of it makes sense. And in certain areas, like on reservations, it would make sense to have a different rule. So these are not nonsensical concerns. But yet, the way that the Supreme Court conducts its analyses, they require voters to produce heavy evidence of burdens in order to subject state election laws to any kind of rigorous scrutiny. But they don't require states, unless it's a huge burden, to come forward with actual evidence that their laws are necessary, say, to prevent voter confusion or to promote voter confidence or prevent fraud. And so we have this asymmetric issue. And one of the things that I would do in my proposed constitutional amendment, which is contained in an appendix in the back of the book, A Real Right to Vote, is I say that we've got to change the way that the courts do the balancing between state interests and voters' rights.
So can we talk about, before we get to the appendix, you talked about the asymmetrical scheme here and how the burdens seem to be somewhat off when we think about who has to prove that there's a problem with a voting law or who has to prove that there's a benefit to a voting law. And since this is largely a legal podcast, I'm hoping you'll dive into the weeds for a moment for us and talk to us about how the Supreme Court got here. What were the cases that led to this asymmetrical scheme, or what are the cases that really allowed for the place we're at now, where I agree with you, I think there does need to be a constitutional amendment? Is this something that is more recent with the conservative court? Does this go back a lot further, maybe, than people might realize?
So the court's been around for 235 years, last time I counted. And I'd say for all but about 8 of those years, the court has not been a great friend of voting rights. I mentioned the two cases, Minor versus Happersett and Giles versus Harris. There are plenty of other cases. We could talk about Shelby County versus Holder, where the court killed off a key part of the Voting Rights Act. There was this one period of time in the 1960s, during the period of the so-called Warren Court, when the court expanded voting rights. So one of the early stories I tell in the book is about a man named Herbert Carrington, who was a sergeant in the U.S. Army. He was stationed in Alabama, and then the Army moved him to White Sands, New Mexico. He moved himself and his family to El Paso, Texas, which is near White Sands. And he went to vote in the Republican primary and was told he was not allowed to vote because the state constitution disenfranchised military voters unless the person was a Texas resident before joining the military. Hard to imagine today Texas having such an anti-military provision in their constitution, but it was in there. And the sergeant had to go all the way to the United States Supreme Court to fight for the right to vote. He had better luck than Virginia Minor or Jackson Giles. The Supreme Court said he did have the right to vote and located that vote right in the 14th Amendment, in the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It was a very generous and capacious reading of the 14th Amendment. And it's not a reading that I think that the originalists that now dominate the current United States Supreme Court would agree with if they were deciding these things as a matter of a first impression. So you have to understand the Supreme Court, except during this period of the 1960s, has been very hostile to voting rights. The only thing that prevents further backsliding is that the court generally adheres to precedent, although we know from the decision in the Dobbs case a few years ago that they don't always, even on big issues. That's another reason why we need a right to vote enshrined in the Constitution, because I don't trust the Supreme Court to continue to protect voting rights in the way that it has in the past.
So can you bring us into that appendix for a little bit and tell us in the Real Right to Vote, what does the constitutional amendment look like? Because I know we talk a lot about we need constitutional amendment in the wake of Citizens United. There has to be a constitutional amendment. And then things sometimes fell apart when you ask people, well, what's the specific wording here? So what's the best way to try and protect this right and make sure that we don't, you know, do more harm than good?
So some things that we would do in a constitutional amendment is simply codify some of those rulings from the 1960s to say everyone has the right to vote if they're a citizen, adult, resident, non-felon. Votes should be equally weighted. This came from that same period of time, the one person, one vote rule, right? So, you know, these are some basic ideas that are part of a norm of political equality that I think exists in the United States for the most part today, although the right to vote, as we know, is still somewhat contested. I would also, as I mentioned, make it easier for plaintiffs to win when they face burdensome laws. So you can imagine having a standard like no one should have to wait more than 30 minutes in order to be able to cast a ballot on election day. So I go into more details about how to make this work and not how to turn every decision of an election administrator into a federal constitutional case, but we can do that. Also, there are protections for minority voters in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as it was amended in 1982. These should be put into the Constitution. That would not be anything like racial quotas. It would not require having race taken into account in perpetuity. What it would do is it would say, so long as there's racially polarized voting, so long as white voters and minority voters tend to vote for different candidates, there needs to be some protection so that minority voters, like the majority of white voters, can participate in the political process and elect representatives of their choice. I also would impose not a national election administration system. I mean, that would be my ideal, but that's a non-starter in this country. But I instead require each state to proactively register all voters and also create a system of national voter ID. Will be different than state ID because the government would bear all the costs and burdens of establishing the system. But it would create a system with both great integrity and great access. And one of the things it would do is it would eliminate a huge swath of election litigation. So another problem we face in this country is that we face a ton of election litigation. Many of those issues are about voter registration. And if we could get rid of those complications and have universal voter registration, universal identification, we get rid of a lot of that litigation, make things much smoother. Other countries are polarized. Other countries have lots of fights over who should win the election. We, among advanced democracies, are pretty unique in fighting over our election rules all the time. And part of that is the decentralized partisan nature of our elections and the failure to protect the right to vote in the Constitution.
So I want to ask you one more question about a real right to vote, but you've mentioned this a couple of times, and I've read what you've written or some of what you've written about the case dealing with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but you've used words related to decentralized when it comes to elections a couple of times. And I would just love your thoughts on the Supreme Court's concern that if we allowed one state to say that, for instance, a federal candidate or maybe just a candidate for the presidency is not qualified for office because they, in fact, engaged in an insurrection or gave aid or comfort to those who did, you know, again, that this person is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which I've talked about a lot in the past on the podcast, that this is a huge problem because it would create a patchwork when it comes to elections. And I'm wondering what your response was to that argument, because you know that there is not maybe the uniformity that a lot of people think there is when it comes to elections, including federal elections.
So I'm of two minds about this. First, the national point generally, as you suggest, is a silly one. So let's take this election and let's take the case of whether RFK Jr. is going to be on the ballot. Is he going to be on the ballot for president or not? Well, the answer depends on where you live. Some states have easy ballot access requirements. Some states have difficult ballot access requirements. In some states, RFK Jr., I think in Michigan, he's going to run on the line of some party that barely exists in the state, but that still has the right to the ballot. Democrats are trying to keep him off the ballot because they think he's going to hurt Biden. We don't have anything like uniformity when it comes to this. So I'm not very sympathetic to the general argument that we need uniformity in our decentralized system and that the court has to stop Colorado from deciding who can go on the ballot. After all, the Colorado legislature, we're told in Bush versus Gore, could take back the power in future elections to decide for itself, and it could use whatever criteria it wants. If it wants to say he participated in insurrection, presumably they could say, we're not going to vote for him. Okay. But what I am sympathetic to, or at least have some sympathy to, is this idea that the standards under Section 3 for when someone is disqualified for participating in insurrection or giving aid or comfort to the enemy, they're murky. And we're in a highly polarized atmosphere. And already, when after Colorado decided to remove Trump, there were noises coming out of Texas. Maybe we're going to say that Biden can't be on the ballot because he is doing bad things at the border, and that's like an insurrection. And so you'd have a kind of race to the bottom. So I think that I can understand why the Supreme Court does not want to, in real time, deal with this standard. It's not like, okay, I'm removing you from the ballot because I know that you were not born in the United States or because you're too young. You have to be 35 to be president. Those are easily administrable standards. I mean, there may be borderline cases where someone fights about where they were born, but generally speaking, these are easy cases. This maybe requires too much discretion. I think that's where the issue was. The part of the opinion that I found the most frustrating was the part that was not clear about what Congress can do and how Congress could remove someone. Because I actually filed a brief with a couple of other lawyers, Republicans, Democrats, arguing that we need some certainty. We need to know if Trump appears to be reelected, if Democrats can try and disqualify him on January 6, 2025, when they count the Electoral College votes. And the court wasn't clear on that. And they said some stuff that really upset some of the other justices on the court, but they didn't clarify it enough. It was kind of the worst of all worlds.
That was my impression of Justice Barrett's concurrence, which is we've mucked it up in 15 different ways. We haven't given clarity, but we've given more guidance maybe than we need to, but not helpful guidance.
Yeah, I have a slightly different read of Barrett because she was more upset with the liberal justices who were nominally concurring but looked like they were dissenting.
Yes.
I think what must have happened is that the majority opinion must have said more in draft about this issue, and the liberal justices were upset, like, how could you do this? This is not something that is even before us. The only question is about whether a state can do this, not about Congress. And I'm guessing that the majority took it out, but the liberal justice kept in their angry language, and Barrett was upset with them. It's like, come on, we saw this side compromise a little. You can lay off a little.
That makes sense. Also, because the per curiam slash majority read like it had been edited very quickly. Either a lot had been added at the end or taken out at the end, but it didn't read to me like the typical, more careful opinion you might expect. As long as we're somewhat off topic, I heard you mention that in part the concern when it comes to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, well, if Colorado can kick Trump off the ballot, then could Texas kick Biden off the ballot? And I'm wondering if you heard echoes of that. I think you characterize it as a race to the bottom. If you heard echoes of that yesterday in the arguments dealing with presidential immunity from criminal prosecution, I heard a lot of, well, if we don't provide immunity to this president, then when it comes to the next president or the next ex-president, it seems to me that they are very concerned about these kind of political retribution parade of terrible examples that they keep thinking about.
It was bizarre because we have an actual example of an attempt to subvert the election, and yet they're thinking down the line of what happens if something really bad happens. Something really bad already did happen. You know, a lot of the justices saying, I don't want to talk about this case. Well, for good reason, they didn't want to talk about this case. So I thought it was strange. It did convince me that there are at least four justices on the court that are likely to, at least in part, side with Donald Trump and say that he's partially immune for certain acts. It's not clear where they're going to go, but the key point is it's going to be messy and it's going to require a lot of work on remand. And that's all Donald Trump wants, which is basically to run out the clock in the hopes that he will not be put on trial before Election Day for what I consider to be a much more serious crime than the crimes he is currently on trial for in New York.
The hush money payment, which I never predicted would have been the first trial to go, nor do I think it is the most important. But I think you're exactly right. They're going to go in this immunity case for some sort of middle ground. I mean, there were so many struggles around along the way. Is it official acts versus unofficial acts? What's the test? Are we just talking about core functions that are given only to a president? Do you need in the congressional statute that the president is charged under specific and clear guidance? All of which is to say, my sense, I think, is what you were saying, which is it's going to be messy. Judge Chutkan is going to have some work. She's, of course, the trial court judge overseeing this case. And then whoever feels unhappy about her decision can go back up to the D.C. Circuit. And here we are, I think, sometime around fall, having not had a trial in this case before the election.
Right. It's not even clear. It may go back to the circuit to do some work first.
Right.
I it's just not even clear what's going to happen. But I already think it's too late to have a trial unless the court does something surprising in the next few weeks.
Which my guess is they will not. But I know that our time is not unlimited, and you have been so prolific. We focused in the first part of our conversation about a real right to vote and the benefits of a constitutional amendment. And I do want to, for a minute, as we're closing, talk about one of your other recent books, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It, because this does seem to me to be at the foundation of so many of the problems and concerns and anxieties that we have about our elections. And so I think people generally understand that disinformation is a bad thing, that it is harmful. Could you point out for us the same question I asked about the right to vote, some of the ways where this manifests, some of the examples where you thought, yes, I'm going to write a book about this?
Well, when I was writing this book, I started writing the book before the 2020 election period was over. Some of the comments on the early drafts were, you know, like, you're exaggerating. Disinformation is not a big problem. We've always had, and it's true, we've always had rumors and false information about elections. And then the 2020 election happened and the aftermath happened. And, you know, I don't like the term the big lie, but I would say the false claims that the 2020 election was stolen or rigged, that is something that millions of Americans believe today, and that has no basis in reality. That is the biggest disinformation success that we've had in this country. Donald Trump was able to go to Twitter about 400 times to speak to millions and millions of people in the 3 weeks between Election Day and as the votes were being finalized in each state. If you imagine that we had the same politics that we have today, but we had the technology of the 1950s, Donald Trump would not be able to, in an unmediated way, relentlessly share this message. You know, there'd be channels 2, 4, and 7, a couple of local TV stations. You'd have your local newspaper, the New York Times or whatever. They're not going to cover him unmediated each time he says this. And so there was a filter And there was context. And what the change in technology has done, among other things, is that it's provided a pathway to directly share, for political or pecuniary purposes, to share false and damaging information. And so we have a problem in this country with disinformation, but we also have, which I think are crucial, the protections of the First Amendment. And so what Cheap Speech, the book, is struggling with is the question, how do we maintain a vibrant political debate that is absolutely essential and protected under the First Amendment with the equally important idea that voters are going to have access to reliable information so that they can make choices consistent with their interests? And it's a difficult problem. Some of the problem can be solved with law. Much of the problem can only be solved through the actions of civil society and responsible companies, responsible entities in society. So big part of what I talk about is what is currently before the Supreme Court in the net choice cases, which is this question about whether governments can force social media to carry content. And, you know, it's an interesting case because there are some on the right that think that Donald Trump was wrongly removed from Twitter and they want to be able to have laws that force the carrying of disinformation. And then there are some on the left who believe that we need to allow for equal access rules that people had wanted for television when television was a medium of scarcity. There were only so many television stations. And so we'll see what the Supreme Court's going to do there, but I'll be watching that case very closely because that case and a few others that the court is looking at in the speech area will have a real huge implications for how elections are going to be conducted and how companies will have the ability to decide, just like a newspaper does, whether or not to carry false and dangerous information from demagogues.
So in terms of solutions and ways to combat disinformation, I know what you say in the book and what I just heard you say is there are some laws and then there are some things that we can do outside the scope of legislation that involves companies acting in a more responsible way. Can you highlight for us, what do those laws look like?
The laws would mostly be laws that require disclosure. For example, one of the things we're worried about is generative AI being used to create videos that, you know, what if it's a video showing Donald Trump saying something that is, I'm not sure what Donald Trump could say, but something that would be politically embarrassing for him to say that he didn't actually say, or, you know, a video of Joe Biden looking like he's collapsing or something like that. And rather than having a law that says, remove the deepfakes, because I think that would run into the First Amendment, a law that requires video that has been altered in certain ways to be labeled as altered, then voters will know when they're looking at this, well, this is not something that is the original. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what about satire? Well, you can put that on satire too. You know, it's like, so there's a label on it. Slightly changes the message, but it gives voters important information. So labeling is, you know, is one way to deal with these kinds of things. Having rules about transparency that lets the government be able to know how social media targeting, micro-targeting is going on. There are things we can do. Maybe they're not enough. But other things that have been proposed, what I like to say is imagine the person you think is the most dangerous person you can imagine as president, and imagine that this person gets to appoint the election czar or the disinformation czar, and you can see how that could be a potential problem.
Understatement. Yes, I can absolutely see how that would be a potential problem. I could talk to you about these issues for hours, but I've already held you longer than I think we asked you for. So Professor Rick Hassan, Professor of Law and Political Science, Director of Safeguarding Democracy, the Safeguarding Democracy Project. We talked about two of your more recent books, A Real Right to Vote and Cheap Speech. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.